Hello and welcome to the Commonweal Policy Podcast. I'm Dr. Craig DL, I'm the Head of Policy at Commonweal, and this week I'm joined by two special guests. I am joined by Donald McPhillamy and Callum Blackburn, authors of our recent policy paper, The Mosaic of Life, part of our land reform series. Hello, Callum and Donald, how are you?
Hi, great.
Good. Nice to be on, Craig.
Thank you. Great to have you. Now, this paper, as I say, was the third paper in our land reform week that we concluded a couple of weeks ago now. The first paper on that was called Work the Land. It was a paper that went through the kind of jobs that we could see in Scotland's rural economy if we were really bold and enacted the kind of land reform that Scotland needs. So more jobs in farming, more jobs in forestry, more jobs in rewilding. The second paper in that series was called Our Land, and it really focused on the policies that we needed to enact to create that meaningful reform. But this week we're going to be talking about the third paper in that, Mosaic of Life. This paper really looks at that vision of what that land reform would actually look like once it's done. So, Donald and Callum, I'd like to just hear a little bit about each of your journey in this topic of land reform, where you've come from and why you're interested in it, what your expertise is, and how you got involved in this project specifically. So, Donald, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, it's easy to answer the last question first, which is that Robin asked me if I would write a paper on land use, so that was how it came about. My background is ecology and forestry. I did a degree in ecology and forestry at Edinburgh University a while back, and I've been working in kind of all the kind of byways and alleyways of forestry, not the big Sitka spruce plantations, but kind of everything else since then, and ran a tree planting business for a while and so on. So I've always been interested in land use, mainly from the forestry point of view, but increasingly from the conservation and, as we now like to call it, the rewilding point of view.
And Callum?
Quite a different background. Also, similar answer to the last question. I was speaking to Robin, and he ended up introducing Donald and I together. So that's how we ended up writing something. I did a master way back in the 90s. I did a master's in environmental studies, and I did my dissertation on a review of protected areas, so natural history designations. And at that point, I was heavily involved in the Scottish Wildlife Trust. I was on a wildlife reserve management committee, etc. So I was doing quite a lot. And then I started getting jobs in sustainability. And so I've spent the last kind of 20 years involved in developing public strategies for sustainability, circular economy, environmental issues, and in the latterly, until last year, I was head of policy and research at Zero Waste Scotland, and probably known for helping develop the kind of pioneering strategy on the circular economy, making things last, that the Scottish Government produced about 5 years ago. And so I've actually just started to come back into this area. I've always, like Donald, I've always been fascinated by land use and always been really interested in ecological systems and forestry. And I suppose I had my own little journey. A year or two ago, I went back to that wildlife reserve that I was involved in the 1990s and looked at it and was thoroughly disappointed at how far it had moved on. There was still sheep on there, and it kind of regenerated me into this area. And so I've started to come back now into looking at rewilding, as the new term is, but kind of looking at how we can solve the problems that I thought maybe we were going to solve 20 years ago, and we haven't. So that's my story.
So maybe we should just take readers to the listeners to the fundamental question here. Why is land reform important, especially somewhere like Scotland? Donald?
Well, I think I come at it not quite from the land reform point of view. I see land reform as kind of a means to an end rather than the end itself. For me, it's all about the land and how the land is used, and how it's been abused very seriously for at least the last 200 years, but probably longer than that. And basically, we've burnt it, we've deforested it, we've extracted nutrients from it, we've segregated the land uses, we've depopulated the land, you know, with the clearances being the kind of absolute epitome of that. Basically, Scotland's uplands are in a shocking state. I think the Scottish Tourist Board deserves some kind of Nobel Prize for tourism, you know, the way that they're able to sell Scotland's landscape as being wonderful, because once you kind of look at it through an ecological lens, Scotland is not wonderful. It's in a very, very bad state, and we're paying a lot of public money to keep it in that very, very bad state. So it's about time that all began to change. And of course, the new thing which has come along to make it change is the climate and ecological emergency. That's what really has to drive the agenda from now on.
Of course, people do have a kind of romantic image of Scotland's uplands. So, you know, what changes when you look at it through that ecological lens?
I was going to jump in there, Craig, because yeah, I mean, in some ways I wish I'd never been taught about ecology, because I could look at the hillsides and go, oh, aren't these fantastic? But like Donald, when I look at them, I see all the things that are not right, that are not natural, that are human interventions. So it's a challenge. I mean, once your eyes are opened and once you understand what should be there, primarily native forest in our uplands, but a mixture, a mosaic, as we're calling it, of different things that would naturally occur. It's very difficult for you not to see that every time you go out for a walk in the hills or hillside. But on the positive note, when you do come across that mosaic, and there are places in Scotland where it's present, it's fantastic. And you really do see and enjoy that walk much more than if you're in that degraded landscape that Donald mentioned. And part of the incentive for me is, and I was mentioning about circular economy, the circular economy is all about us as humans living within the natural boundaries of the planet and being aligned to ecological systems and living in a way that works as part of ecological systems. And in the moment, that land, the way it's getting used, is just not productive. It's not really aligned. It's incongruent with that. So once you kind of realize these things, and once your eyes are opened, you're a bit more aware, you start to spot it wherever you go. As I say, back to my original comment, sometimes I wish I hadn't been educated and I would still have that romantic notion of Scotland without realizing it's not really what it says on the tin.
I think Scotland has got a beautiful bone structure. That's how I put it. You know, the mountains, you know, the islands, the lochs. I mean, the basic structure of Scotland is beautiful. It's the kind of the skin over the top of that structure which has been, needs a bit of a makeover.
So let's talk about this paper. You described it as a mosaic of life, and as I mentioned, it is kind of a vision of what Scotland could look like after we do all these reforms and get that skin healthy again. So maybe if we imagine ourselves as a walker standing on top of a hill looking over a glen in Scotland, what would we see now, and then what would we see if your paper is adopted and everything is done?
Well, right now you see very few trees, and the trees you do see tend to be conifers in plantations, all even age, monoculture and species which have been imported from the west coast of North America. That's what you see at the moment. You see very segregated land use. You see the forest is over here, and the sheep country is over here, and the deer country is over here. And then you've got the lowlands where different things happen. And then you've got the grouse moors over here, which are sort of burnt on a regular basis. You know, the land use is kind of very segregated, and it's basically very treeless, except for softwood plantations, which are not really forests in the kind of ecological sense of the word. So what we need in the future would be something which is a lot more wooded. So rather than have sort of like bare, barren, empty countryside as the kind of matrix, you switch that on its head and you say, well, what if, you know, we had that area was woodland, natural woodland and scrub, and all sorts of habitats within which these different productive land uses like softwood growing and some livestock farming could take place.
And I think one of the things is, like, you know, when you, the top of every mountain is naturally going to be a little bit bare because, you know, trees only go up to about the 800 meter mark if we're talking about sort of natural regeneration, if they're allowed to regenerate naturally, and those top trees will naturally be smaller and stunted, etc. But the other thing you would notice as a walker would be the variety of color and the variety of texture, because when you have, as Donald's talking about, more woodland, but you have more native woodland and more mixed woodland of different ages, then you have that lovely sort of, people just notice it. It's just lovely to look at because it's got variety. It's got also a lot more wildlife. We're going to have a lot more wildlife if this vision comes in, and that's obviously the core of it, because that variety of woodland and variety of uses is what will provide a good ecological basis for wildlife. And of course, we're probably also going to, if you've got more woodland, your eye's probably going to be drawn more to some of the water features and some of the peatlands that we have. I think some of our peatland just gets lost in amongst a landscape that we have now. And actually, when we do have that more kind of mosaic, then the peatlands probably stand out more, and they'll be more interesting as well, because hopefully they'll be in more restored nature. And you'll see the difference between a peatland and just a piece of blank grazing land, as we often have now. So, yeah, so trying to add a bit of colour and texture to it for you as a walker when you're walking around.
Well, one comment I have had from the paper is that word mosaic, to at least one person, summoned an image of little patches of preserved wildland scattered around the place. Is that what you're looking at, or are you looking for something that's a bit more connected?
Well, I think, what would grow would be what would grow naturally. So different plants will grow naturally in different kinds of soil, different kinds of climate and different kinds of altitude, you know. So the mosaic would be kind of not artificially created as like little islands. It would actually be the whole thing, and it would change according to the soils and according to the bedrock and everything else. So, it wouldn't feel artificial. It would feel very natural. And you just have to go across the North Sea to southwest Norway to see exactly what it would look like, because southwest Norway was just as barren and just as devastated as Scotland was about 150 years ago. And I'll tell you the story. It was the Homesteads Act in North America, which offered land to Europeans to go out and colonize the West in North America. And a lot of poor farmers from different countries, particularly from this part of Norway, headed off to the promised land. And the land they left behind had enough of a seed source, had enough trees already on it, and had few enough deer, which was very fortunate. And the forest expanded. And actually, within the last even 50 years, there's been quite a change in southwest Norway. And so if we want to see what a rewilded Scotland mosaic would look like, we just have to go to southwest Norway, and there it is. It's almost exactly the same soils and geology and climate as we have.
I think one of the things as well is that, you know, obviously in the paper we've mentioned, you know, commercial forestry, and as Donald said, that commercial forestry at the moment is primarily Sitka spruce from Northwest America. And, you know, long term, you know, one of the things we have to do from an economy perspective is look and see, how can we get more commercial value out of the native woodland that we have and the native species that we can grow here, or even near natives, you know, things that are pretty good ecologically but are not quite native in the strictest sense. And that's one of the things we need to pursue. So although we might have the odd patch of what looks like commercial woodland mixed into that mosaic, you know, I would think over decades we would gradually find that we needed to rely on that less, and more of the woodland might be native species, because we've cracked the technology or the way of using native species more effectively in our economy. So that's a personal view that I have.
Yeah, something that we've talked about at Commonweal is advocating for more use of wood in, for example, house construction, especially when married with technologies that produce things like cross-laminated timber. So we can make more use of different kinds of wood. But one thing, again, we've found when talking about land reform is when we mention that idea of commercial forestry, people do shy away from it slightly because it does conjure up that image of more spruce plantations that are, as you said, monocultured and then clear cut. What does commercial forestry look like, you know, in this mosaic in a way that's sustainable and marries with the Green New Deal?
Well, I mean, it would be a sort of continuation of forest. It would be a development of forestry as it is at the moment. And a lot of people in forestry are very, very strongly in favour of that move away from the sort of the serried ranks of Sitka spruce, you know, the monoculture, and towards a more diverse sort of forestry anyway, you know, leaving aside the whole mosaic, the whole new vision. But that's kind of the direction that forestry is going in anyway. And there's a concept called continuous cover forestry, which is becoming, you know, it's becoming almost the norm. It's becoming almost the mainstream. That is kind of what forestry is heading towards, and it means that you can grow commercial trees, commercial timber, without the kind of the, you know, Battle of the Somme clear fells that have been the case in the past, and so as forestry kind of evolves and fits into this bigger vision, which has got a lot more native woodland kind of enclosing and encapsulating the commercial forest, we can actually have more forestry in the landscape, more productive forestry in the landscape, which is great for locking up carbon, and it's great for producing timber, and it's great for substituting other products like plastic and steel and cement with timber. We need forestry and we need timber. And we should remember as well, going back to Norway, the first time I ever saw a glue lamb factory was in Norway, in southwest Norway. And it was being made as a family business in a factory surrounded by forest in a beautiful location. And the timber was Norway spruce, which was being turned into these fantastic big spans of glued together timber. And we don't have Norway spruce as a native species in this country because of the ice age. But we do have this kind of like super Norway spruce called Sitka spruce, which is actually a really, really good tree, which gets a very bad press. And if it's not as dominant as it is at the moment, and it's kind of managed in a different way to how it's managed at the moment, it's an absolute gold mine for Scotland. You know, it's a wonderful tree and a wonderful resource to have.
I should probably declare a slight interest in tree growing here, because my partner and I are just about to plant some willow, and we're looking forward to coppicing that in the years to come. Not on a commercial scale, but we should be able to make something interesting out of it.
Sorry, I think we need the whole range. I mean, that's always been my point of view, is that, you know, we just need the whole range of species and forestry types, you know, and now we're extending it into, you know, kind of unproductive woodland as well, and even right, you know, higher up the slope into scrub, which is going to be full of wildlife and so on, and won't have any commercial value at all, but it's still kind of like trees and scrub. You know, so I'm arguing for the whole range.
And I think one of the things is, I kind of slightly disagree with Donald saying unproductive, because I suppose we're both talking about it, that in a commercial sense, but now we have a unique opportunity, because, you know, like Woodland Carbon Code has kind of set out a way where you can actually get some commercial value from some native woodland, whereas before you didn't have that open to you. So, you know, there's a massive amount of big industry out there is looking for carbon offsets, and you can say what you like about carbon offsetting as to, you know, its overuse rather than actually addressing the fundamental problem of using fossil fuels. And that can be very true. But if it does drive, if it helps while people are transitioning over to renewable energy, if they're offsetting and doing that in a sensible way with native woodland, then it can really drive that woodland to become something that does have an economic value rather than just being totally unproductive in a set of commercial sense. So there are some changes afoot, and there are opportunities, you know, regarding the agricultural subsidies as well, which obviously we've left Europe, and now there's an opportunity to change those for the future. And again, that could yield something that is akin to a productive commercial payment. We don't know yet, because there's nothing that I'm aware of that the Scottish Government's published, but we'd like to see something like that kind of stimulates that, so we can get to that half wild, we can get to that 50% of the cover is maybe not commercial, but it's certainly wild and has value in many senses. So yeah,
I definitely like that phrase in the paper, the half wild Scotland. So continuing our look over this imaginary glen from the top of our hill, we have the mosaic of wildland, we've got the commercial forestry, but what does this mean for folk who are crofters or upland farmers? Is this going to have to change the way that they farm?
Well, the crofters are mostly around the coast, you know, and that's a kind of a different situation. I think there's a place for sheep on the low ground, you know, around the coast. And I think the position of sheep in the landscape has to change. And if we're thinking about sort of like the non-coastal areas, but kind of the inland areas, you know, the higher ground is not where the sheep should be. You know, higher ground is where the rewilding and a certain amount of forestry and a certain amount of a different kind of livestock farming can be taking place, plus a lot of other activities. You know, the sheep should be in the fields. You know, that's really where the sheep should be, because they're not as hardy as we like to think they are. You know, it's like there's a high death rate among sheep regularly, and we have to use very hardy breeds in order for them to survive at all, and these hardy breeds don't produce very good wool, and the wool is kind of like low quality, low value, which means that the actual cost of having a sheep on the land is about £26 a year. It costs a sheep farmer about £26 per ewe per year to keep that sheep on the hill on the highest ground. And that is then subsidized by the taxpayer. So that loss of £26 per ewe is converted into a very small, very low income for the sheep farmer. So it's a completely unsustainable model. And in our paper, we argue that, yes, we would like to see sheep. Yes, we'd like to have wool and probably breeds which produce better quality wool. Yes, we'd like to have higher lambing rates and lower death rates. And that would be achieved by keeping the sheep on not the low ground, but kind of some of the middle ground, you know, combined with farm woodlands to provide shelter, which will give the sheep a sort of like a healthier life. And that's really where the sheep should be.
Can this strategy also mitigate problems or arguments against things like reintroduction of predators on the basis that they might compete with farmers?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously the one that's mostly in frame. I mean, I totally agree with what Donald's just said there, and it's a very difficult thing for governments and policymakers to just sort of say to a group of people, we kind of have to change the way you're doing things. But, you know, from a productive point of view, it doesn't really make sense, as Donald's already highlighted. I think one of the things, yeah, I mean, if I was looking at, I think it would help introduction of things like lynx. Lynx are ambush predators. So if you have, like sheep, in sort of farmland, then that's probably a much better situation. But we, yeah, you'd have to be careful about the woodland scenario, because you know that's where lynx tend to operate. That's where they hunt their deer. So if you have sheep up in a mixed in with the woodland on the hillside, it wouldn't be the most optimum use of that woodland, but it would also increase the chances that if you introduce lynx, then they'd probably be more prone to be in the line of the lynx's eyes, if you like. So yeah, but I think the increase in the woodland on the uplands obviously will help introduce a range of different species and just increase the overall ecological diversity and quantity of species that we have. So yeah, but I think it's a very good point you asked, Craig, because I think we now have to start thinking about everything we do about potential future reintroductions and how that's going to fit.
Yeah.
Donald, have you anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, rewilding for me is all about getting the sort of vegetation right, first and foremost. And then if you do get the vegetation right and you get tree cover coming back and scrubbed and so on, then you can look at the animals which would come back and take advantage of that, the birds and then finally the apex predators like the lynx. And I could see the lynx coming back in the not too distant future. I mean, we're almost at a point where we could start thinking about lynx already, because they are kind of quite secretive animals. The Scotland, based in the Cairngorms and the Cairngorms Connect area, could probably sustain a population of lynx as we are at the moment. So it's just the main obstacle is the sheep, so if the sheep go out of the equation on this land, then it's kind of a no-brainer really to bring the lynx back, and they would help to control the deer population, which needs to be reduced for all of this to happen, and particularly the roe deer population. So I know rewilding means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and that's I quite like that, because it gives you sort of lots of room for discussion and argument within it. But for me, it's all about getting the vegetation restored and then seeing what is possible after that.
I agree with Donald, and I think it is the point that people have different visions or different ideas of what that vision looks like, is that's kind of what it's all about, isn't it? So, the diversity of people looking at this, but coming together with a kind of common vision. So, yeah.
Yeah. And a final part of what Scotland is now is, of course, things like the sporting estates and grouse shooting. Mm. What are your thoughts on that, and what place would something like that have in a reformed Scotland?
I'm glad we got on to grouse. Didn't forget about grouse. I'm sorry, but driven grouse shooting has just got to go. I mean, there's just no kind of economic argument for it. There's no justification for it. It's an abuse of the land. It's all this effort by gamekeepers, going into eliminating the predators and the competitors of one bird species so that their numbers can be artificially inflated, so that a very small number of wealthy people can come along and stand in their grouse butts and have the grouse driven over their heads so that they can shoot them at their leisure for fun. That is just not something which is acceptable or desirable in any way. So out of all the changes which have to happen, for this vision to take place, the one I feel most strongly about and I've got the least qualms about is really the end of driven grouse shooting. Now, having said that, I think there possibly is a role in the future for walked up grouse shooting, which is where you get a party of people with guns and dogs, and they don't have any beaters, they don't have any burnt land. It can be in regenerating woodland, regenerating scrub. It can be in a much more healthy ecosystem than the driven grouse moor. And that may be possible, and that may be acceptable in the future, but that's different people will have different opinions about that.
Is that how you see it as well, Callum?
I I mean, I suppose I come from the... I know less about it than Donald, so I'll admit that. But I come from it from a kind of wider perspective of behaviours. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time doing research on people's behaviours. And, you know, one of the things that I'm just wondering is how long socially it can be acceptable to do what Donald just outlined, you know, in terms of shooting things for sport. And I just feel that we're at that point where society's starting to change and question these things, and just, you know, so I wonder how long it can survive from a kind of public acceptability point of view. So, yeah.
So we have this vision now. Time to start talking about how do we get there. I mean, they often say the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is now. But how quickly could Scotland start to make this transition?
Well, the first thing to say is that it's happening already. You know, the first thing to say is that the sheep are coming off the hills, deer numbers are being controlled in some places very successfully, in other places less successfully. Forestry's changing. And then we have rewilding experiments going on in quite a large scale in quite a lot of places. And you think of Glenfeshie, and you think of the Cairngorms Connect, Abernethy, Mar Lodge Estate, you know, mostly private landowners, but also Abernethy's RSPB, so that's the kind of environmental sector, and Glenmore's Forestry and Land Scotland. So it's kind of a combination of private, public, and environmental sectors who are all contributing to this. So the answer is it's happening already. But it has to happen faster, and it has to happen in more places. And we have to change the systems around in order to encourage it to happen. And that means changing the grant system around, because basically landowners, land managers, they pretty much do what they're paid to do, you know. So if you change the system around, and which is actually happening in England now faster than it's happening in Scotland. So really, you know, the sort of politics and the subsidy system and so on need to catch up with what's already happening and to push it in the right direction, because we're in a climate emergency. You know, we can't just sort of piss around for another 10 years or 20 years and allow the lobby of the status quo to kind of, you know, determine that nothing changes. So we need to speed up the process, make it sort of happen more places, and it's all achievable. It's all achievable, and it has to happen.
And I think it's ramping up, you know, obviously in terms of targets for forestry because of the climate emergency in particular. But I think there's some care there. We could end up having vast areas of, because of the price of timber at the moment and the demand for timber, we could have vast areas getting planted in the wrong way. So we do have to be careful that the ecological side of it is considered in this kind of vision, as well as the commercial angle. But we've also got the carbon offsetting agenda, as I mentioned earlier, is really, really taking off, and people are looking to do something that's good, and awareness is growing about what we need to do, and understanding of the ecological emergency alongside the climate change emergency. So it's interesting. I was kind of doing a bit of a poll myself among some of my friends, and some of them read this paper and go, "Oh yeah, that's the way I've always thought it's going to be," you know, the vision. And then others are like, "What's this all about?" So you know, we have such a stratified a grouping, but again, we've got a huge opportunity, as Donald says, with the changes in subsidies and changes in planning system. And we've got some, you know, NPF4, the government's planning framework, who's already, they've recognised that they need to take on board nature and ecological emergency. So it's really kind of like, how are you going to build that into what is predominantly a human development planning framework that we've had in the past? So there's lots of things that could happen.
Yeah, I think the trends are good. We've got some good trends, but we don't have the vision. You know, Commonweal's now got the vision, you know, and that's great because that then feeds into other people's thinking processes. But I wouldn't say the Scottish government's got the vision yet, you know, and they need to get the vision. They need to sort of get this kind of overall picture, and for that to be not tinkering around the edges of status quo, but, you know, sort of like a new vision, which we think is, you know, we've laid out in this report, we offer that as a really good vision for the future. And there is work going on at the moment for a national land use strategy. I mean, that's kind of what we need. What we're talking about is really a vision, a strategy. And then as that gets discussed and debated, then it can be applied at different levels, regionally and so on. So that's kind of where we need the effort. We need a good national strategy, land use strategy, and we need that can be linked in with the national planning framework as well. And we need to have a national debate about this and try and bring as many people along with that new way of looking at things as possible. Because some people are going to feel quite threatened by change. You know, some people's livelihoods are going to be threatened by change, even though there may be greater prospects in the future for jobs and for rural communities. We haven't talked about rural communities so far, but, you know, rural communities are very fragile. So again, the system, the current system doesn't work for people in rural areas to any great extent. So, you know, they deserve something better. And this vision would actually, as your paper on land reform showed, you know, would create more jobs in all the different sectors. So more jobs would be there. There might be different jobs, some of them. And those people would be living in the rural communities, and those rural communities would be stronger and fitter and better places to live.
So if folk are listening and they're interested in this vision, or if they've read your paper and they want to know more, how can folk get involved, or how can they keep up with your own work?
Well, I'd say I get a lot of inspiration and information from the Rewilding Scotland Facebook group, which I helped to administer, which was set up by Reforesting Scotland. And we've got over 17,000 followers for that now, and it's a very dynamic group. So that'd be one thing people could do, is just join in the chat, you know, join in the debate. And I think the more people that join in that debate, and we have people there, you know, from a gamekeeping background, from a shepherding background, you know, from rural communities, from fishing, because again, you know, we need to rewild the seas as well as rewild the land. So there's quite a strong debate, you know, in terms of salmon farming and issues like that. So just jump in. That's what I say. Jump in, you know, enjoy the debate. And then we just have to work out how we can get the Scottish government in its new form after the election, whatever that may be, to take these issues, give these issues a high priority. Because if Scotland's going to meet its targets, 2045, zero carbon, then agriculture and land use have got to play a very big part in that. And we're not going to meet those targets the way things are at the moment.
Yeah, and I would just reiterate what Donald said about the election there. Now you've got a good time to actually go and ask some of the candidates some of these questions and put that into your decision making about who you're going to vote. Do they have the inspiration and the vision for what's required? Because some of these things are going to be quite challenging for governments to implement. As Donald said, like, we are talking about a major transition for some people, and that's going to be managed fairly and effectively. Myself, I've, as I kind of indicated right at the start, I've kind of been inspired to get back involved in this. So I'm in the process of starting my own company, Half Wild, which I will no doubt post onto the page that the Facebook page that Donald mentioned when it's up and running. What I'm looking to do is actually take some practical steps there and buy up some of the grazing land and rewild it. So I'm kind of working on the business model for that, and I did some work with the Edinburgh Centre for Carbon Innovation, ECCI, last year on the concept of that and how it could work. So I'm going to be piling on my head with that. So I would ask people to look out when they join the Facebook page that Donald mentioned. And yeah, just try and think about these things, and whenever you come across any information that you see, I would try and put your points across to the decision makers and the policy makers, and get them to think about it.
I'm certainly hoping that this is one of the topics that will be high on the agenda in the election campaign to come. Well, Donald, Callum, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you both for coming on. And just to say to all of our listeners, as we always do at the end of this podcast, Commonweal, as an organisation, we are entirely funded by folk like yourselves who donate a small amount, £5 or £10 a month, to allow us to produce this podcast, to allow us to promote the policy research that we do, and to produce this vision of a Scotland that works for all of us. So, Donald, Callum, thank you once again. And for everyone else, we will see you again next week.